morning. So it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Justin Barrett today. He describes himself as his high school teacher's worst nightmare, being a combination of a science geek and a fundamentalist. But you can read more about that in his chapter in the recent book on How I Changed My Mind About Evolution. So he's director of a PhD program in psychological science at Fuller Graduate School of Psychology. And his new initiative is the chief project developer for Fuller's Office for Science, Theology, and Religion initiatives. He taught for 5 years at Oxford School of Anthropology, but he's best known for his research on the scientific study of religion. It's not without controversy, and he's authored many books, including Why Would Anyone Believe in God?, Cognitive Science, Religion, and Theology, and Born Believers, The Science of Children's Religious Belief. And he will be talking more about this in his talk on the current trends in the science of religion. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Barrett.
Good morning. This is the book that Janet made reference to. It's got lots of, it's a BioLogos and Ivy Press academic. You can check it out. There in the book exhibit. It has lots of essays by pastors and scientists and a number of people, including a handful of people who are here with us today. So check that out. It's a lot of fun hearing people's stories, the story behind how these people became scientists and what they're doing now. On Friday night, Bill Newsom shared some really fascinating neuroscience with us that I thought was not only just really cool, but also he managed to challenge the idea that that somehow neuroscience defeats the idea of free will in any simplistic sort of way, but left open that there are some really interesting, important areas of theological engagement that believers could be having with neuroscience. With the new findings, it's not that we can just write them off, oh, free will is still okay, but there's some really interesting points of thoughtful intersection and sort of grappling that need to happen, but that we can do that confidently and not from a fearful position. I want to do something similar with my time, but instead of, no, I'm not going to show you videos of Randy Mice, you know, getting violent and stuff. This is Sunday morning after all. But I do want to share with you a little bit, give you a taster for what's going on in a scientific study of religious beliefs from the cognitive and evolutionary sciences, and to assure you that, at least to this point, God beliefs are safe. They're not explained away at all. Nevertheless, there's some really interesting opportunities for theological engagement here, so they shouldn't be ignored either. So that's kind of what I want to do with my time. So now you can just stop listening, because I've just told you. But here's the overview. I'm going to turn this up, because I might get excited and get too loud. First, I want to just introduce you to what in the world are the cognitive science, what's cognitive science of religion and evolutionary studies of religion, two areas of inquiry. Explain what are some of the on-offer byproduct explanations of religion, that is, religious beliefs as a byproduct of evolved systems in our minds. And then some adaptation, or for those who are persnickety about this, some of them actually maybe exaptation kinds of explanations of religious beliefs, and then go into some philosophical and theological musings, mostly just to try to get you excited about this, not really to sort of conclusively solve any problems. We don't have enough time to solve all the problems. We just raise some good questions, right? Okay, so that's where I'm headed. I'm fully aware that even well-trained scientists don't necessarily know what cognitive science is. It's one of those things that doesn't show up in the textbooks. Partly that's because it's newish. The term has only sort of gotten in vogue really in this millennia. But really its origins are about 60 years old now. Cognitive science can be thought of as an interdisciplinary area of science that's really the science of the mind. I didn't say brains, I said minds. Because it's really, the emphasis is on how does thought function? How do we think? How do we learn? How do we form concepts? How do we categorize stuff? How do we perceive? And while you'll see neuroscience is on my list of contributing disciplines, is not necessarily just looking at what's the brain doing, but only what's the brain doing insofar as it informs how we understand how thought and learning and et cetera work. All right? But these are some of the constitutive disciplines: artificial intelligence, linguistics, anthropology of a certain sort, psychological sciences, neuroscience, and philosophy, particularly philosophy of mind, all contribute to this area called cognitive science. Cognitive science of religion, then, draws upon the cognitive sciences to try to get explanatory purchase on why is it that so many people throughout history and all over the world end up forming similar kinds of concepts that we might call religious. That is, it draws upon cognitive sciences to explain how culturally recurrent features of human minds and their natural and social environments inform and constrain thought and action we might call religious. At least that's one way to define the area. Okay? I want to note there are no particular commitments to any given one model of how the human mind works. That's open. The enterprise here is just saying, whatever you think is the best science concerning the mind, how do we use that to better understand religious thought and help account for why, on the cultural level, we see groups gravitating towards these beliefs and practices you might call religion? Okay? I want to distinguish cognitive science of religion from evolutionary studies of religion, because they're often conflated in the literature these days. And so just give you some benchmarks here. Evolutionary studies of religion try to explain the existence and persistence of culturally recurrent features of human social groups that we might call religious, including shared thought and behaviors, by considering whether or not they might be adaptations. And they can be, explanations can work on many levels of evolution here, many levels of adaptation: group, individual, multi-level, gene culture. There are lots of different explanations on offer there. The two areas do overlap considerably, and that's why they sometimes get muddied. But I wanted to spell them out because they do have distinctive features. Folks working in evolutionary studies of religion sometimes make no reference to what's going on in human minds. They just don't. They go straight to behavior, or straight to group-level behavior by some kind of appeal that, oh, it'd be good for a group if, kind of thing, if they have beliefs in gods that help morally regulate or something like that. No attention to psychology, let alone cognitive psychology. And some of the cognitive side can make no reference to evolution. And in fact, when I started in this area, I wasn't really making any reference to evolution because it was not directly pertinent to what I was doing, at least not evolution in the normal sense. Okay? So while they're overlapping, they are distinct areas. But I've also drawn a line underneath there and suggested there's a continuum of explanations, or at least folks over in the evolutionary studies of religion camp tend to offer adaptationist accounts of religious beliefs and practices. People solidly on the cognitive science of religion side tend to offer byproduct accounts of religion. Okay? Again, there's some overlap in the middle. There's a big area of overlap in the middle, and some people are mixing accounts, and I think that's fantastic. But just to sort of give you a lay of the land. Now, what do I mean by these kinds of accounts? I'm going to start with byproduct accounts. In general, the idea of these accounts of religiousness as a byproduct is that people are disposed to generate and accept religious ideas because of how their minds naturally work in common human environments, only by virtue of just ordinary cognition, that one or more cognitive subsystems evolve to solve other kinds of problems, but they make us really receptive to religious thought, or make us more inclined to believe in a god, or an afterlife, or a soul. Okay? Not, they didn't evolve for that, if we can use that teleological language necessarily. Okay? But that they, as a byproduct of their ordinary functioning, they incline people in that direction. They're called byproduct accounts. And I've given you some book covers of examples of treatments that really are following this. Scott Atran's, Pascal Boyer's, Bob McCauley's recent book is tough but really good. And then mine, which is really easy. And probably not as good, but there you go. Somebody's got to do the easy stuff, right? Let me give you some of these examples here of how you might appeal to ordinary cognition. I'm going to be bold here. The genius of this approach really is by observing that. Look, if you're going to explain cultural level phenomena, the recurrence of what happens on a group level, it's really useful to look downstairs at human psychology. Yes, that's that sort of scientific reduction that we've heard about. Okay, it's really helpful to look at, well, what's the underlying psychology that might make these sort of group level phenomena bubble up? And what a lot of folks don't appreciate, and that's why I'm going to highlight it, is there's actually a lot of cognitive content that human minds seem to develop just as a natural part of, you know, growing up in ordinary human environments. You can think of it as analogous to the way that lots of animals have lots of instincts, right? For different kinds of behavioral routines, ways of processing information, and so forth, right? Quick example, the difference between squirrels and birds, at least a lot of birds, in terms of the way they gather and hide food. You might know squirrels sort of are arbitrary, random, just we bury stuff all over the place and we hope we find it again later, and they often don't, so oak trees sprout up all over the place. Whereas birds have this amazing system for remembering pretty much everything that they hide. Okay, I'm overgeneralizing here, but they are remarkable. They seem a lot smarter than squirrels in this regard. But they've got two different kind of instinctual cognitive strategies for mapping where do they find food. Well, humans seem to have something that's analogous to these instincts as well. Okay, it's not the case that our minds are just blank slates, general processors. Some combination of our human biological endowment that includes our entire sort of our brains, bodies, and the whole nine yards, plus the developmental environments we typically grow up in, lead us, by the time we're about 4 or 5 years old, to have this whole suite of subsystems that have characteristic features that developmental psychologists have been identifying now for about 40 years. Here's an example what side is this? My right side. We've got a photo here of Andy Meltzoff from his famous infant facial imitation studies. There have been some failures to replicate some of his findings, but it still looks like a safe claim that within 24 hours of birth, babies are able to imitate sticking out the tongue. That's really cool. Right? Why is that so cool? Well, I mean, think about it. Babies, first of all, have really lousy visual acuity when they come out. And they're slime covered and the whole nine yards. Just gross. Squirmy things, but they're already selectively trying to find face-like things in their environment, have to attend to those things, process that visual information, somehow map it onto their own muscular structure to do this kind of thing, and they do, and they don't even know they have a face, presumably, right? But yet their cognitive system just does that, because human faces and that kind of exchange with human faces is so important to our species. Arguably, that would be why they have this. Other stuff that seems to kick in early are domains of what are called naive physics, or sometimes called folk mechanics. It looks like babies very quickly, within the first 5 months, become Aristotelians when it comes to physical objects. I'm only sort of half joking here. Actually, if you want to know how the typical 2-year-old thinks, Aristotle is a good place to start. That's not a slam. He just had good insights about the nature of human thought. He just happens to think that, and therefore that's the way things are in the real world. But naive physics there's a whole list of sort of principles that developmental psychologists have identified for how it is that babies just make sense of the way that bounded physical objects work in the world. Here are two of those, contact principle and support principle. And I've said contact principle, we've got pretty good evidence now that it's in place by about 5 months old. And the basic idea is an object must be contacted to suddenly change its movement or direction, launch, and so forth. Okay, babies at 5 months old show evidence that they get an object, ordinary object, can't just launch itself, and it can't just stop itself, and it can't just change direction. Something, another physical object, has to act upon it, okay? And then the support principle comes in a little bit later, and that's the idea that an unsupported, bounded physical object will fall, okay? It comes in a little later. So we're not saying these things are all present at birth, but they're a normal part of human development. Sometimes it's called maturation or natural. How do we know this? I'll give you just one little sort of reconstruction of the kind of evidence that developmental psychologists use. They'll stick a baby in front of a display. These days we can use computer displays. It used to be sleight of hand, kind of puppet showish things. Now it's computer displays where we can show them some kind of thing like this, a ball rolling down a ramp, and we'll do it over and over and over. And the great thing about babies is they get bored and they let you know it. So they start fussing and looking away, and all right, I'm tired of this. I'm seeing the same thing over and over, and you're noticing something. Why isn't that ball coming out? What you're seeing there is an occluder, a screen that's hiding something. What we want to know is, what does the baby think is behind that screen? So you show babies something like this, and then for half of the babies, you do the reveal, and you see if their attention gets recovered. The other half, you show the reveal and see if that recovers their attention. And what experimentalists find is that in this second case, that's when the babies go. Oh. There. Whereas in the previous one, they go, no, I already saw that, basically, right? And behaviorally, they give that indication of, same old thing, I'm not seeing a difference here. Suggesting that's what they were already expecting behind there. Babies are really rough to work with, so I give these people props. Okay, so it looks like from studies like this with little babies and other kinds of clever experimental, cross-cultural, and even species comparative studies, we've got this whole suite of sort of mental tools that we carry around in our heads. I'm kind of oversimplifying the picture, but among other things, that we solve particular problems with these tools. They've got their content-specific systems. They solve, that one's for physical objects, the face system is for faces, right? And we can think of it that way. Well, what systems then might have encouraged us to believe in gods? Stuart Guthrie is one of the founders of this sort of cognitive approach. He's an anthropologist, and he said, well, look, humans seem to anthropomorphize willy-nilly all over the place. It's a cross-culturally recurrent phenomenon. They anthropomorphize, or make in human form, natural stuff of the world. Why do they do that? Well, his contention is, look, there's experimental evidence and there are evolutionary considerations to think that our minds should do that kind of thing. It's good for them. It's good for us to have what I've then termed this sort of agency detection system, or agency detection device. You'll sometimes see the word HAD in this literature, and that stands for hypersensitive agency detection device. My fault, bad nomenclature. It was really easy to throw around, but I'll come back to why. I think that's really not helpful at this point. But Guthrie's idea was, look, if you miss the sign of agents in your environment, other people or these big predator animals, that's bad, right? So your system for detecting these guys better be tuned up to the direction of more false positives as opposed to missing, target missing, right? It's called error management. Because the cost of failing to detect a tiger or a camouflaged enemy, human for that matter, can be catastrophic for your genes. But it's getting a little bit too excited. Oh, is that a tiger? Oh, I guess it wasn't. Not a big cost there. So given the gravity of the cost of failing to detect, the system should be tuned up to over-detect. And his contention is then some of that over-detection might lead to the postulation of unseen agents. All right, when I was living in Oxford, I come home from my regular routine, it's a bicycle home from the office, go around to my back garden gate, open a door that's hard to open and grinds on the gravel, and then walk in and put my bike away. One day, my bicycle, I go to the back garden gate there, I reach for it, and it just opened. Ooh. So my agency detection device is going, wait, someone is here. It didn't go, oh, the laws of physics somehow have been disrupted momentarily. It's no, it's someone is here, is where my mind went first, but of course, it first went to, one of my loving children surely has rushed out to greet me and opened the gate for me. They heard me coming. Well, that's sweet. But then I saw no one. Guthrie's thought is that in situations like this, you might be tempted to postulate an unseen agent. Or if you already have the idea of unseen agents around, this might reinforce that idea. Because Oxford is full of ghosts. All right. What's going on here?
Why is this? Click on the image.
Another sort of suite of cognitive mechanisms that have been identified have to do with how people think about natural objects in the world, not in terms of the physical properties, but what are they for and where they come from. This work was sort of dubbed intuitive theism or a design bias by Deborah Kellerman, a Boston University developmental psychologist who has sort of in a workmanlike fashion over the last 20 years or so put together this amazing body of work showing that preschoolers seemingly, regardless of culture, are inclined to see the world as purposefully designed, at least elements of the world, like mountains and rivers and suns and animals. And they readily attach that perceived design to an intentional being bringing it about, okay, purposing it. She also has evidence that suggests this bias persists into adulthood unless you are explicitly taught that that's the wrong way to think. It has to be tamped down. We don't just outgrow it. But it's also the case that children, by the time they're about 4 years old, know perfectly well that humans don't make mountains and rivers and animals. So kids, they see design, they see purpose there, they wonder who did it, and they know people did it. So they've got this conceptual gap that's just waiting to be filled by the right kind of God. Not all gods will do. What's some of the evidence here? Well, some of our early studies were just showing pictures like these pointy rocks and asking kids, just open-ended, free-form, so why do you think the rocks are so pointy? And kids would generate these teleological kinds of explanations, like, well, they were pointy so that animals wouldn't sit on them and smash them. Okay? And then later, drawing upon those kinds of explanations that kids gave, she pitted them against each other with new groups of kids and said, okay, there are two people, you know, are trying to account for this. One says they're pointy so that animals wouldn't sit on them and smash them. And this person over here says they're pointy because bits of stuff piled up on top of one another for a long time. Which do you think? In those kinds of studies, the kids still favor those teleological kinds of explanations over the mechanistic ones. Even if an adult is advocating for the mechanistic one, they go, yeah, no. Yeah. I mean, the parents in the room know this kind of stuff happens, right? So through studies like that, she's established, look, it looks like kids are really inclined toward these sort of purpose and design-based kinds of explanations. And then further studies suggest that kids bring that into reason about where did things come from in the first place. So one fun study, she asked kids things like, why did the first ever bird exist? And here are some things kids said. Well, to make nice music, because it makes the world look nice. I assure you the Pasadena parrots do not make nice music. Flying around here, these feral birds. Why did the first monkey exist? So then we had somebody to climb trees, so there can be an animal in the jungle. And why did the first ever river exist? So boats could come into the water, so that people could do fishing. Right? I mean, we've got our boats, we need some water here. Come on, river up. So kids are already then taking that design that they see and thinking that has something to do with origins. In more closed-ended kinds of questions, she'd ask things like, so we've been talking about rivers, or mountains, monkeys, birds, whatever. Now here's the question, did someone or something make the first ever mountain exist, or did it just happen? And of course, these were all counterbalanced and, you know, all of that other good stuff. And what she found is that by and large, kids favored the someone explanation over the other two explanations, especially for animals. There is almost 3/4 of the time, and the other 25% has been split the other two ways. So overwhelming tendency toward seeing some kind of design behind the origins of animals. You might think, okay, that's cute kid stuff, but how does that structure adult religious belief? Well, she's recently been showing, Kellerman has, that it looks like these tendencies persist into adulthood unless we effortfully tamp them down. Here's one of the studies that suggests this. She gave adults, college-educated adults was where she first started, who had at least a couple of years of college-level, bachelor's-level science. She's recently moved on to PhDs and gets similar kinds of effects, by the way, in both the U.S. and in China, and asked, basically, are these good or bad explanations? And gave lots of different explanations for lots of natural things. Ferns grow in forests because they provide ground shade. Earthworms tunnel underground to aerate the soil. polar bears are white because the sun bleaches them. Okay, all of these are bad explanations on a certain level, right? But the first two are teleological and bad explanations, and the last one is mechanistic and bad. And generally, your science-educated adults, non-science-educated adults, she's checked, actually like those first two very well, thank you. Okay? And in fact, some evolutionary biologists like them just fine, too, for complicated reasons we can talk about. But in general, science-educated adults think these are all bad explanations. What happens then if you make them answer very quickly whether they're good or bad? A common experimental technique that, you know, cognitive psychologists use to sort of increase load or demand, that kind of peel back your facade and see how do you really think, sort of instinctually, will make you answer fast. Well, suddenly those teleo-functional kinds of explanations look pretty good. But their accuracy on things like polar bears are white because the sun bleaches them actually goes up. Okay? They were already almost at ceiling levels, but yet they get even better with those kinds of things, as if some people were second guessing their answers. I don't know, maybe polar bears do bleach bugs. All right, so maybe we've got this agency detection kind of system or anthropomorphism system that makes us detect agents even when there's scant evidence. Maybe too, and I think this is a really strong claim actually with lots of evidence, children and adults see design and purpose in the natural world, so they've got this, well, who done it then? Kind of question that's sort of lingering out there just waiting to be satisfied. Well, here's a more complicated kind of byproduct-y explanation. It's actually one of the older ones, and I don't present it very often because it is multi-layered. Because it appeals to lots of different systems. It says, look, you can have your agency detection system, you can have your teleo-functional system, there are all these other systems out there that are delivering intuitions that we might call natural intuitions about how things are in the world out there, about solid objects, animals, people, and so forth. But what matters not is not that a person believes in a ghost or a god, it's that a group of people come to that belief. So why are some ideas not just generated, but why are they stick? Why are they worth talking about? How do they bubble up to become shared cultural concepts that we'd identify as religious? Well, you got to talk about them. You got to communicate with them. And Boyer observed, this is Pascal Boyer's kind of theory, that if an idea is just too intuitive, too natural, it's not worth talking about. On my way here this morning, I saw a shaggy brown dog. Okay, Barrett, what's the punchline? Who cares? Too intuitive. Okay? You generate lots of inferences about that shaggy brown dog if you want to. Like, its parents were probably dogs. It moves itself. It tries to procure food and so forth. If we cut it open, it's made of natural stuff, not of gears. Okay, four-year-olds know this stuff. You don't have to communicate it. You get this conceptually rich package because of that group membership. But who cares? It's a brown dog. Well, I encountered an invisible dog on my way over here this morning. Ooh. Barrett's crazy. Or you're thinking, well, how do you know you encountered an invisible dog? Wait, if there are invisible dogs in Azusa, that would explain, you know, who pooped on my car. Right. Boyer's observation is, look, if things are really intuitive, they're easy to communicate, they're easy to move as a conceptual package because they don't stress us too much. But they're more interesting, they're more likely to be talked about, they're more likely to capture our attention if there are little tweaks in there that increase what he calls their inferential potential, that make them explain stuff that otherwise isn't readily explained, maybe. If you go too far, though, this is why it's called the cognitive optimum, if you go too far to counterintuitive kinds of ideas, I ran into this invisible dog. That's parents were cats. That sustains itself on crude oil. That doesn't exist on Wednesdays. And it only remembers things that never happened. Well, I've completely eroded the conceptual structure, and so now it's not a good candidate for a cultural concept. I mean, I don't even know how to put all that together into anything coherent for the kind of information processing machine that we all have. Okay? It's just a laundry list. So, ideas that are minimally counterintuitive then are more likely to be remembered and communicated successfully. And then if they've got this little tweak that adds inferential potential that matters to the kinds of things people care about, that makes them even more memorable and reinforce them through talking to each other and frequent reactivation. Intentional agents do this job nicely, like you and me, like minded ghosts, because they have goals, they have desires, they can violate basic physics, seemingly, right? Unlike those sort of brute objects that have to be contacted, I can move myself. So I have a lot more inferential potential than a book, even an invisible book. Though I could throw it at you and you wouldn't know it hit you. Okay, but an invisible person, they might know our secrets. They might know when we are cheating on each other. And they might punish us. Why did I just trip that? Someone did. Okay? So that makes them more interesting and more likely to bubble the top. To sort of summarize this sort of religiousness as a byproduct approach is that religions aren't adaptations, here to quote Scott Atran, and they have no evolutionary function as such. But because of the way that our different cognitive subsystems work together, they're these conceptual spaces, like in a shape sorter game, that's just waiting for the right shape to go into that space that the cultural environment then provides. And then we go, it's a winner. Doesn't matter if that round shape is blue or green or purple, as long as it's round, right? And there's something analogous here. That's the byproduct thing. Sorry, there's a whirlwind kind of tour of these. Then there are these religion as adaptation kinds of approaches. People are disposed to generate and accept religious ideas because being religious somehow improved our ancestors' fitness. And so are the genes of religious folks, or the gene culture complex of religious folks, or whatever it is, whichever level you want to work on, gets reinforced and passed on. What do some of those look like? Well, there's this sort of school of commitment signaling theories, and there are different variations on these. But the basic idea is, look, people are groupish animals. We live in packs. And there's good reason to think that living in packs is a very good thing. Right? Group living is good for fitness. But there are some risks involved. I need to know that I can trust you, especially once we're in groups of non-kin, and there isn't any sort of easy way for me to just say, well, it's in your best interest and my best interest for us to work together because we're kin, now we're sharing the same gene pool or whatever. When we're getting non-kin groups, suddenly we've got defector problems. I could cheat you, and if we all go out on the hunt, instead of me manning my post so that we can bring down that mammoth, I see a rabbit run by, I should snag it. Because then I get a snack, no one else knows about it, but I can still share in the mammoth kill. Winning. So there's that temptation to defect then, and so then we need to police defection as it goes. But then that bears a cost too, and then we need to police the policing of defection, and you need to police the policing of defection. And so there are all of these cooperative kinds of problems that have to be solved. One proposed solution to this, it's not my favorite, but is that we signal our commitment through allegedly costly displays, like religious rituals, like initiation rites, that we wouldn't otherwise do unless we were true believers. We don't go through that really boring worship service in the morning if I didn't really believe this stuff. In fact, you can see the tears of sincerity on my cheeks at the appropriate time. That's sometimes called charismatic signaling in this area, actually. I'm not even kidding, because you need something that's autonomic, that's hard to fake. Otherwise, people can fake the signals. And that's actually best for me if I go to that church, because it's good for my business contacts. But I'm not a true believer. But people are going to figure out if I'm not. So there need to be demonstrations, the community needs to police in another way. Pathos is one way to do that, and it's been proposed. All right, these are all different versions of signaling your commitment to the values of the group and that I'm not going to cheat you after all. And it's thought that religions do this really well, hence they build more cooperative communities, that then gets selected for. I've got a picture up here of some kibbutz communities from Israel. There's Richard Sosis, who's been a champion of signaling theories, actually has some really cool evidence showing, this is just one example, but comparing religious versus secular kibbutz communities in Israel and finding that the religious ones are actually more cooperative and more trusting of each other. They're economically more successful and they've been lasting longer, even though they're newer. But their degree of trust and cooperation as indexed by various economic means actually is predicted by the frequency with which the men pray together, which is kind of interesting. That they're apparently, I mean, his interpretation, they're signaling to each other their commitment to the same God and same values. All right, but I better trot along. Another variation on this to solve the cooperation problem is basically the fear of supernatural punishment thesis, as it's been called. And here are two books that have different takes on this. Jesse Baring's The Belief Instinct, or sometimes it's called The God Instinct, depending on which side of the Atlantic you're on. And then Aaron Noren Zion's Big Gods, How Religion Transformed Cooperation and Conflict. Both of them say, okay, all of that byproducty stuff, that's the background. But then you've got this cooperative problem. And morally interested gods are a great solution to this policing problem. If you think the gods might be watching when you might cheat and might punish, you're less inclined to cheat or defect. You're at least going to try to give the appearance of being cooperative, which usually means you're going to have to be at least somewhat cooperative. It's going to curb the temptations to cheat or free ride on the community. And so then that tendency, whatever complex brought people to the point of thinking that there are morally interested gods around, possibly watching, is going to get selectively reinforced. Okay? That last bullet, Noren Zion adds that rituals and other kinds of religious displays prime or remind people of their commitments, in a way. Remind them that gods might be around. It's a little bit like drawing little, you know, eyes on the honor box, you know, next to the coffee. If you draw eyes on it, people are more likely to put money in than if you don't. It's just to remind you someone, really, it's been done, experimentally. It reminds you somebody might be watching, so I better behave myself, is the argument. And their suggestion then is that's what religious participation and having churches around and calls to worship, that's what it does for us, is it reminds us that gods could be watching, we better behave ourselves. And there's actually some interesting kind of broad data that is, you know, at least looks to be supportive of that position. Okay, so those are, just a very quick introduction to some of the kinds of explanations that are on offer here. So what and who cares? Does having some natural explanation of religious beliefs undercut those beliefs? Does it explain them away in some sense? Well, there's sort of a... Notice how I said that. Does having some natural, just it doesn't matter which, that you have one, is that doing the undercutting? Let's dismiss this one pretty quickly by just going to William James, who wrote, there is not a single one of our states of mind, high or low, healthy or morbid, that has not some organic process as its condition. Scientific theories are organically conditioned just as much as religious emotions are. Right? I mean, that's an easy sort of first pass, is look, if you're worried that, oh no, somebody figured out what brain circuitry is responsible for believing in God, well, there's brain circuitry that's going to be active when you're believing in not God. So just that there is brain circuitry is kind of irrelevant at that point. That there's an evolutionary story to tell, it doesn't necessarily tell you anything. Right? I mean, there are evolutionary stories for why I think that, you know, my mother loves me. Does that mean I should stop believing that my mother loves me? That just doesn't follow. I could have gone then to J.K. Rowling, who is a more authoritative source. So this comes from book 7, for those who don't know these things. And I'm not going to bother with the spoiler thing, too late for you. The scene here is that Harry is dead. And he's talking to Dumbledore, who is dead. They're clearly in some kind of afterlife because it's described as, like, looks like King's Cross Railway Station, but clean. You know that ain't happening in this life. And after their conversation, then, Harry says, tell me one last thing, said Harry. Is this real, or has this been happening inside my head? And then, of course, not. Well, of course, Harry, it's been happening inside your head, but why on earth should that mean that it's not real? Says Dumbledore. Which is a nice little line. Use that in your classes. Just drop it. Good point. Pretty much the same thing that James said. Here's some more interesting arguments, though. I'll give you three of them. One I think applies and is motivated by byproducty kinds of arguments. I'll call it error-prone system one, for lack of a better term. And then two that I think apply to either byproduct or adaptation arguments, error-prone system two, and then the no causal connection argument. These are inspired by some comments that Michael Murray, philosopher, had put together, but I have my own reflections on them as well. Here's error-prone system one. Here's how the argument might go. And we'll, I have agency detection in parentheses because this is kind of what inspires it, but it need not apply to that system. Look, a cognitive device or devices either spawns or nurtures theistic beliefs. Experimental evidence and evolutionary considerations give us reason to think that it generates false positives. You heard me talk about that with this agency detection system. Because it generates false positives, it's unreliable. Beliefs spawned or nurtured by an unreliable mechanism are unjustified. Hence, theistic beliefs are unjustified. Okay? That's a little bit more interesting argument. But what might we do with that? Well, Murray starts with this kind of critique. Well, look, belief-forming mechanisms of any sort vary in reliability with context. Consider vision. Under these lighting conditions, I could probably do a pretty good job estimating the number of people in this room. I could even count them. But if we shut the lights off entirely, suddenly my visual system is unreliable for giving me that information. Context matters. So if his agency detection device produces religious beliefs in contexts in which it is reliable, then those beliefs aren't suspect. If, on the other hand, it produces beliefs, religious beliefs in contexts in which it's unreliable, then those beliefs would be suspect. So we need to know the particular context of theistic belief formation and the particular reliability of that device in those contexts. We don't. And he's right about that. We just don't. Hence, the argument, at least at this point, doesn't work against religious beliefs. You follow me? Okay. It's a little bit like saying, hey, sometimes your eyes get it wrong. Eyes form, you know, the belief that there's been a fire nearby. That's not exactly right, but let's go with it. You can't trust that because your eyes get things wrong sometimes. Well, that doesn't make sense. All right. We need to know more. Here are my further comments. Surely it's not, though, a device like agency detection by itself. I gave you at least two, and there are many others that have been implicated here. So it's this agency detection device plus other mechanisms, at least. Maybe all of these or all of these that are in me. It may be that even if this agency detection device, or whichever one you like, is prone towards false positives, the whole package might not be. That is, there may be some corrections built in the system. I gave you the example of me walking to my garden gate and thinking someone was there. Do I believe that an invisible person opened the gate? No, I overrode that belief. So the entire package of belief formation actually had a corrective built into it. So really, we don't need to know just is ADD by itself error-prone. We need to know is the whole package error-prone or are there corrections within the system? Second point, it may be that this agency detection device is important for some gods but not others. So it's too fast to sort of try to cut them all down. It may be that it plays a really important role for generating beliefs in ghosts, forest spirits. Maybe it just perpetuates ancestor beliefs but wasn't part of their origin, and maybe it has no discernible role at all when it comes to a cosmic deity. Maybe, we just don't. Okay, error-prone system two then. This one, more interesting still. I'll just quote Murray here. Whatever cognitive tools are involved in spawning religious beliefs, one thing is clear, the beliefs spawned are obviously mutually incompatible. Any cognitive tools which give rise to mutually incompatible beliefs in this way are obviously unreliable, and any beliefs arising from them would then have to be taken to be unjustified, at least absent some sort of independent evidence of truth. As a result, religious beliefs arising from these tools cannot be reasonably accepted absent independent justification. Okay? But then Murray goes on and he says, look, the incompatibilities that you might find don't necessarily arise from the cognitive mechanisms themselves, but from cultural sources and not these basic, naturally functioning cognitive systems. Hence, this plurality of beliefs doesn't count against the belief-forming mechanism's reliability. Let's see if I can get this to work. I can. So what Murray is saying is, yeah, there's this diversity of beliefs out there,
But the diversity comes in this process, which are cultural inputs, not from the natural cognition generating this sort of general generic kind of belief that there are some kinds of gods out there. So this diversity then doesn't count against this reliability over here.
A couple of other observations on that point. This actually, this strict exclusivism that sometimes the anti-theists want to saddle us with actually is pretty rare. Even these monotheists sitting in this room right now, as probably most of you would consider yourselves, my guess is most of you also believe in angels and devils. Some of you may believe in ghosts and other spirits. That's pretty common, actually. It's not the case that most people in most religions go, oh, you believe in that God, I believe in this God. Well, you're wrong, that God doesn't exist. They say, my God's bigger than your God. Your God exists, but mine is awesome and yours sucks. That's usually what goes on, and that's a very different kind of thing. Okay? Consider moral truths. There's interesting evolutionary and cognitive kinds of evidence now that there's sort of moral foundations that anchor a lot of our moral thinking. But there's obviously a huge diversity of moral beliefs. Does that mean we have no reliable, justifiable mechanisms for forming moral beliefs? And also consider lions, tigers, and bears.
Oh my.
Oh my. So imagine I'm an Oxford Don, I used to be, and I'm on safari in South America, trekking around the Amazon. I come across a tree that looks like this. So there's big scratch marks in it. Fortunately, I'm out there with my wiser, more experienced, travel companions, an Asian outdoorsman, an African outdoorsman, and a North American outdoorsman. And the Asian guy says, we better get out of here. There's a tiger nearby. And the African guy says, we better get out of here. There's a lion nearby. And the North American says, you're both wrong. There's obviously a bear nearby, and we better get out of here. And I say, look, you guys can't agree. You've got a plurality of beliefs, so your belief-forming mechanisms clearly can't be trusted. I'm staying right here. Science of religion or evolutionary states can account for, I'm quoting Murray again, can account for the origin of religious beliefs in a way that makes no reference to and requires no causal connection with supernatural realities. It's completely naturalistic. However, properly justified belief requires that the target of the belief be causally connected to the belief in certain ways that philosophers will fight about. Since these accounts show us that none of those ways that the philosophers are fighting about are in fact in play in the origins of religious beliefs, beliefs so generated are unjustified. Okay? What he has in mind here is something like this. We all think that we're at Azusa Pacific University. I hope we all think that. Otherwise, you're in the wrong conference. You know? I don't know where you're at. But what if we find out that we've all taken a pill that makes us think that we're at Azusa Pacific University? Okay, it's a hallucinogenic kind of pill. Well, now you probably aren't justified in believing that you really are at Azusa Pacific University, right? It's that ABU pill. You sort of see what he's getting at? All right, so your belief then that you are at APU doesn't have the right connection to being at APU. It wasn't sort of causally connected to actually being at APU. And maybe that's what's happening with God beliefs. But then Murray says, look, you can reject the premise that belief in God are not causally connected to the belief. And he reasons this way. Look, and it's sort of apt for an election year. You may have received phone calls from, you know, these sort of automated phone calls that say, hey, vote for Billy Bob Joliak. Is running for the 34th congressional district. Really appreciate your vote. And you might say, well, actually, Billy Bob Joe Hick was not on the other end of that line, and so there isn't a proper causal connection to Billy Bob Joe Hick. Now, that doesn't seem right, does it? Now, he may not have been the direct cause of the phone call, but he's an indirect cause of the phone call, and you're still justified in believing that Billy Bob Joe Hick is running for office. Likewise, it may be that while God is not the direct, immediate cause of belief formation, I think that's debatable. He may have been the indirect cause. by constructing your cognition and your life circumstances in such a way that you would come to believe. All right? Plantinga puts it this way. Look, to show that there are natural processes that produce religious belief, there's nothing to discredit it. Perhaps God designed us in such a way that it's by virtue of those processes that we come to have knowledge of it. Further observations. Look, that indirect cause kind of answer, it doesn't work for all religious beliefs. It's hard to see how, I don't know, the afterlife orchestrated my cognition and natural events such that I would form a belief in the afterlife. Most forest spirits don't have the causal properties attributed to them that would sort of find a way out of this. All right? So it's a good answer for, you know, the creator God. It's not so good for some of these other gods. But just because the cognitive scientists of religion have assumed that there are no gods, they've practiced methodological naturalism for developing these methods, doesn't mean that there aren't any. It may be that the background conditions of their science actually includes these gods. I'm not trying to persuade you that there are forest spirits and ancestors all over the place, but maybe there are, right? We're assuming there aren't. But it could be that that agency detection device only gives you enough had experiences to generate or sustain belief in gods when they actually are around. Maybe it's analogous to the fact that we all have a natural mechanism that makes us believe that each other have minds inside of these human shells, but maybe we would have to have minds to actually form those beliefs. We don't have to make a commitment on that to tell the naturalistic story, but maybe that is the state of affairs. Okay. I'm highlighting just a section of Murray's sort of text here. It says, since these accounts show us that none of those ways, in fact, are in play in the origin of religious beliefs, what I'm saying is that our religious beliefs, or the explanations on offer, don't show us that. They're just silent about that. They haven't shown any such thing. So let's not get so excited. If you want more on these sort of heavy philosophical things, because that just tickles your brain in the right way, here are a couple of edited volumes, Schloss and Murray in 2009 and Trigg and Barrett in 2014. Let me very quickly, because I'm getting the motion over here, but hey, we started late, in fairness. That wasn't my fault. I was here. And here, I really just want to tease you really fast and say, look, I think there's a lot of space for theologians to play here. And I want to encourage that. Some interesting questions could be things like, well, do adaptation versus byproduct explanations raise more theological problems or open more theological insights than others? I don't think that should change our sort of scientific evaluation of these necessarily, but they're questions worth asking. So you might think that adaptation accounts are kind of fun because, well, being drawn to God somehow looks like it's good for us. I'm going to move ahead there, my sort of but on the other side is, but what if many gods will do that same job? There's evidence that having belief in gods of war is good for your group, too. You tend to win wars more often. Adonic Johnson has some interesting evidence on that. Doesn't God beliefs being an evolutionary product make them more solidly part of our human nature, you might think? And I'd say, well, not necessarily. Lactose tolerance seems to be an adaptation, but it only affects about 25, adult lactose tolerance, only affects about 25% of us, and it would be weird to call that sort of essential to what it means to be human, is that I can digest milk as a grown-up. With apologies to the ice cream social later. Well, what about these byproducty types of things? Well, look, byproduct doesn't entail unwanted or not valuable. Art, science, music, clothing are arguably byproducts in the case of clothing, an adaptive byproduct. But that doesn't make it an adaptation. All right. Now I'm being really fanciful, just to close this out here. One of the things that excites me about this area, you can tell I'm excited, and that's mostly coffee, is that what we're seeming to get is scientific evidence that supports certain kinds of theological claims, or at least is consonant with. And that's this idea that to know in a general and confused way that God exists is implanted in us by nature, says Thomas. Or he also said, there is a certain general and confused knowledge of God which is in almost all men. Or planning, or planning, whoa. Is that? The bearded guys, you know, in the Reformed tradition, they don't look like to me. Okay. Al would be so flattered, I just didn't. John Calvin said, there is within the human mind, and indeed by natural instinct, an awareness of divinity. God himself has planted in all men a certain understanding of his divine majesty. This conviction, namely, that there is some God, is naturally inborn in all. Notice that actually Thomas and this guy both say some, a confused knowledge of God. This is referred to as a sensus divinitatis, not a sensus Dei. But that raises some interesting questions for theology and the science to work together, beyond whether it, belief comes from a byproduct adaptation or exaptation of some sort, or secondary adaptation or whatever. But how, if there is something like a sensus divinitatis, how specific are the deliverances of this faculty? Does it make us just sort of generally be receptive to the supernatural? Or does it bring us all the way to a creator God with, who's wholly good and want, you know, that we're to be in a relationship with? Under what conditions is this faculty activated? There's actually disagreement in the theological literature on this. It appears that Calvin, for instance, thought it was sort of just generally churning in the background. Whereas Plantinga seems to think that it's most activated in those moments of awe, when you're at sort of climbed to the top of the mountain, or you're looking through your telescope out at the Milky Way or something like that. But those are open empirical questions. How does it develop in children? And then can we accidentally dampen or distort its effect? Or can we enhance and sort of encourage it? These are all questions, it seems to me, that are both theological questions and actually psychological questions, and bringing the relevant sciences together could be a really exciting fusion. Thank you very much. So I can see you better. If I was doing this, it's because of the glare and angle. The first question is over here, I think.
Yeah, so I'll stand up and try and be loud. Some people will kind of hear this presentation and be convinced that this might be some evidence for apologetic endeavors in the future. But some are also looking at this developmental biology as basically sometimes even being a hindrance to belief in Christian faith. Some of the beliefs that we formulate about God intuitively can sometimes stand in contradiction to the God who died on the cross.
Right.
We typically formulate beliefs about an omni God of the Greek philosophy rather than the God of Christian theology of the cross. And so I was wondering if the intuitive God cannot necessarily be a foundation which springs forth towards Christian belief, but can also, in some sense, also be an hindrance to Christian belief.
Great question. Absolutely spot on. Okay? Nothing I said here says that this sort of the, whatever is the natural, naturationally natural impetus for belief in some kind of God is going to get you to the right one necessarily. Right? This is meant to be an account for basically why is it people believe in any kinds of gods. I happen to think that the deck is slightly tilted toward something like a creator God who is all knowing, immortal, and sort of super perceiving at the very least. But there's nothing in them that says good, loving, and I haven't said anything that there are natural encouragement for forming a personal relationship with such a God. Right? There's something very different about the naturalness of belief versus the naturalness of relationship with this God. So that's an entirely another discussion. Right? So you're absolutely right about that. And it could be that there is, as you're suggesting, an analog here between the way that naive physics is pretty good to get us off the ground, but if you want to actually learn physics, you're going to have to unlearn some of that stuff. Right? Maybe it's the case that our sort of natural kind of endowments pretty good to get us going. At a certain point, you actually have to grow up theologically. That's a great point.
Yeah.
Oh, he asked you your question. That was rude of him. Or a great way to take credit for an excellent question. That's a long discussion. Yes, let me, because I can't say a lot about it in this context, because we're hungry, I'll refer you to a paper I did, it's a 2013 paper in The Monist, which is a philosophy journal, Barrett and Church, Ian Church. If you Google something with beer goggles and BFFs, you'll find it. I wish I were kidding. So, planning on sort of just as philosophers do, has argued that, look, if I can boil it down really fast, that if you don't believe in any kind of God, you're a complete naturalist, then you don't have any good grounds for thinking that your mind actually can deliver you true beliefs. Because natural selection is not interested in the truth of your beliefs, it's interested in whether they are, you know, fitness enhancing. Are they adaptive, right? So, and as you might have been picking up, that agency detection device, for instance, seems to be a system that's tuned by natural selection away from being, strictly speaking, accurate. Because it needs to manage the magnitude of the errors or the fitness costs and benefits that are involved. And so actually I think there is empirical evidence in the evolutionary literature, evolutionary psych literature now, and theory, that really suggests that Al's got some things importantly right here. That, no, we wouldn't expect that our faculties would necessarily be truthing or reliable in the sense of tracking accurate truth, strictly from an evolutionary basis. He then goes on, interestingly, to argue that then, being a theist, you don't have this problem, because you can think, yeah, but God could have made them such that they would do such a thing in the right places. But if you don't have God as your sort of epistemic sort of backstop, you're in trouble. And I do think there's a relationship to this area of research in the following way. If I am an atheist and I think that, which I should say, most of the people who work in this area are atheists, okay? I've sometimes been in popular kind of media stuff, been accused of, well, this is theological insertion into science and stuff, and you're only talking about the naturalness of religion because you're a theist. Like, most of the people in this area are not theists, and the reason they're really interested in the naturalness of religion is they're like, I don't get what these people are going on about, these religious folks. There must be a naturalistic explanation for it, right? But that's the interesting thing, is if the explanation lies in the ordinary functioning of our ordinary cognitive faculties, that leads to widespread misbeliefs from the atheist perspective, then they basically said, our faculties just are confused. Well, then on what grounds do they think they're trustworthy in forming their theistic beliefs? That's hence the beer goggles. I make it analogous to the atheist is going into the nightclub with, you know, and says, but is a designated driver, so he isn't drinking. But all of my buddies are drinking. And they all think, wow, this place is full of hotties. Look at this place. Wow. Oh, they're drinking. That's why they think that. And I'm suggesting there's something actually slightly analogous to the case of the poor atheist. And, you know, they are a minority group in the world who are going, that's what these religious people. Oh, they've got weird cognitive faculties that are mistuned. The difference is our cognitive faculties are not goggles we can take off, right? So I think it actually, the analogy doesn't work, but that's why we're here. We better stop and go to lunch.